The Days That Are Gone, a memoir of the Bousson du Maurier family based on the books of Daphne du Maurier and adapted as two plays for radio by Philip Lever. The second play, The Fire in the Glass.
In the year 1811, on a blustery spring day, the Dover packet lay tied up to the wharf, loading its cargo of passengers and merchandise. From the saloon rail, the more elegant passengers looked down on the lower deck, where their less fortunate companions were spread over the boards, their belongings tied in small bundles or packed into wicker baskets. Mostly groups of the poorer French émigrés, they seemed doubly apprehensive. Apprehensive of the sea and timid at the thought of returning to the land which they'd left in such fearful disturbance. England would no longer support them, and the future was the new France, where they must pick up old threads and look for new patterns. On the upper deck, Ellen Clark, aged 13 years, was sailing to France for the first time, accompanied by her mother, Mrs. Mary Ann Clark, ex-mistress of the Duke of York, the subject of a sensational law case, and the possessor of a substantial income. Provided she lived out of England. Ellen, a pale, serious child, was enthralled by the commotion on the ship and captivated by the sight of a boy standing on the lower deck and singing in a clear, boyish treble.
Oh, Mama, listen to that boy. How beautifully he sings.
He may sing like an angel, but he don't look like one. A bold, impudent face.
What does that matter?
It may matter a lot to some people later on. Mark my words.
I would like to know him.
Well, there's an impudent miss. Picking up boys in a boat. That's the thing I never did. Boldness is all very well in its right place, but you've got to learn how to use it. Where would I have been if I hadn't? Well, you and your brother come to that.
Mama, please don't spoil everything. He is only a boy singing.
Come away, Ellen. You will spoil your pelisse, leaning so close to that dirty rail.
Louis Mascarin! Come down from the ship's side or you will fall.
The lady calling to him must be his mother.
They look like returning French émigrés. Probably very common people. You can see how badly dressed they are. Come away at once. We have been asked to dine below by a very nice foreign gentleman who's travelling to Paris. Come and make your curtsy to him and leave the émigrés to their bread and cheese.
Very well, Mama.
Louis Mathurin! Come down, do you hear? Louise, you shouldn't encourage your brother to run all over the deck.
No, Mama. Louis Mathurin, you have to come here at once. Yes, Louise.
In the early 1820s, Paris had become sober and a little bourgeois. In the Rue Saint-Étienne, the houses were shabby and sometimes forlorn. At number 8, a Madame Poussard ran a maison d'éducation. And here, the daughters of the new society studied German, Italian, and English. And it was to Madame Poussard that Louise Bousson du Maurier applied for the post of English teacher. She had returned to France at the age of 15, and now in her early 20s, she was endeavoring to augment the small family pension to the best of her ability.
If it had been possible, Madame, I would have taken vows and entered the convent of the Sacré-Cœur. For the present, however, I must help to support the family. I must confess that I was not brought up to work and never for a moment believed that it would be necessary.
May I inquire your circumstances, mademoiselle?
We were greatly disappointed when we returned to France. My poor father had always expected that much more would be done for us. The glass factory, founded by my grandfather, was destroyed, and our chateau apparently reduced to ruins.
And you received no reparation?
Only a state pension of 200 francs a year. There are 6 of us, madame, besides my mother, and this is all we have in the world now that my father is dead.
And the rest of your family, how do they employ themselves?
My brother Robert is in London, a clerk in the city.
Oh?
Jacques, who is younger, works in Hamburg in a bank.
Uh-huh.
The 2 youngest children live here in Paris with my mother. And it is for their sake that I wish to teach English here in your pension.
And the 6th? Did you not mention another brother?
Yes. I have another brother, Louis Mathurin. Unfortunately, he has gone against all our wishes and is studying to become a professional singer.
Ah.
It is very hard for us, his family, to see him wasting himself in such a way.
Naturally, brought up as you have been, you could not bear to have a brother on the stage. However, there is nothing dishonorable in teaching, as you realize yourself. If you would care to mention to your brother that I am looking for a singing master, the pay would be small, of course.
You are very kind, madame. When I next see my brother, I will suggest it to him. But I'm a little doubtful. He is so independent.
You yourself, mademoiselle, will have Tuesdays free in which to take private pupils, if that would be your wish. As it happens, there is an English lady here this moment with her daughter, a young lady of about your own age, who wishes to take a short course in French literature. With your knowledge of both languages, I consider she would be an ideal pupil for you. If you will follow me, I will introduce you to them. Mrs. Clark, may I present our English teacher, Mademoiselle Buisson de Maurier, Mrs. Clark from London.
How do you do, madame?
Oh, how do you do?
May I offer you some refreshment, tea, coffee?
No, thank you. Never touch them. Wind under the heart, you know. Can't avoid it when you get to my age. The doctors tell me I mustn't drink with me food. Drink with me fiddlesticks, I say. Mademoiselle Bus, eh? Know what that means in English?
Mother.
Oh, damn you, Ellen, what have I said now? This is my daughter, Ellen. She has a fit every time I open my mouth.
I am delighted to make your acquaintance, Mademoiselle de Maurier. My mother and I have been in Italy for several years, and now we are to settle in Paris for a while. I intend to see all that I can and study as much as possible. Perhaps we could read French literature together, Mademoiselle. See something of the picture galleries. I am rather ignorant of French art.
It would be a pleasure.
My mother and I live quietly nowadays. I fall back upon books and music for company.
You are musical.
I play the harp.
Oh, indeed.
I had a very good master in Italy. At present, we are making certain economies, so I must go without.
Oh, there are excellent masters in Paris. Students at the conservatoire who would be glad to give their time in return for certain remuneration. If you would like me to make inquiries for you, it would be the easiest thing in the world.
You are most kind, mademoiselle.
You know, Mademoiselle Buss, you're too pretty to be a teacher. You ought to find a husband. One day you shall have a little chat with me. I know all about husbands. I was married at 17, and I can tell you what they do and how they do it. Eh, Madame Buisson?
Mama, we have taken up too much of everyone's time already. And doubtless Mademoiselle du Maurier has a class to attend.
You see, Ellen always takes me away just as I'm beginning to amuse myself. Such a good girl. But entre nous, madame, no sense of humour. You ought to meet my son, mademoiselle. Oh, he's a lovely fella. A subaltern in the army, you know. The women adore him. But no time now for his poor old mum.
Mama, we must be going. Mademoiselle, it would be delightful if we could begin our studies next week.
With pleasure.
Don't stare, governess, for too long, my dear. Bad for the complexion. My advice is, take a lover. Nothing like it to put roses in your cheeks.
And so started the friendship between Ellen Clark and Louise Buisson du Maurier, who'd once seen each other as children on the Dover packet, though neither of them knew it. The only cloud on Louise's horizon was, as usual, her brother, Louis Mathurin, who'd abandoned his singing career as suddenly as he'd started it and could now think of nothing but science and making a journey to the stars. One of her pupils at the pension, little Eugénie Saint-Just, had become engaged to the Portuguese Duc de Palmela, and Louise, with Ellen and Eugénie, gave much thought to the approaching wedding.
The marriage will be in January, and dear Mademoiselle du Maurier will be the most honored guest there.
You will forget all about me in Portugal, Eugénie. You won't have time to think about your old teacher.
I will. How could you think me so ungrateful after all you've done for me? Miss Clark, be a witness to my words. I vow here and now that I, Eugénie de Palmela, as I shall be, will cherish the friendship of Louise Buisson du Maurier until I die.
Ah, when you've traveled as far as I have, Eugénie, and seen as much flattery and insincerity, you will know better than to make a vow about anything.
Miss Clark is such a cynic, is she not? I suppose you think me foolish to fall in love. You will tell me that it does not last and that my husband will tire of me.
I consider you very wise to make provision for the future. It is not everyone who has a chance of marrying a Portuguese nobleman.
Affection between husband and wife, when it is fortified by religious understanding, can be a very beautiful thing. I can think of no greater happiness than to attend Mass with a chosen beloved.
Faith in an Almighty came easily to you, Louise. You sucked it in with your first milk in the cradle. I breathed rather different germs.
Malice, flattery, deception. No one ever told me about God. The only religion I've ever learnt was to take care of myself.
Poor Miss Clark. You must be exceedingly lonely.
Lonely? Why should I be lonely? I have my books and my music. I would rather be alone than in the company of most people that I've met.
Oh, let us not dwell upon such solemn things at this moment. Eugenie will be married at Notre Dame in January, and it will be magnificent. Everyone in society will be there. And in the midst of it all, ourselves, wondering, and perhaps a little timid.
Are you enjoying my wedding party?
Oh, beyond my dreams. Now that you're a Duchess, Eugenie, it seems you're prettier than ever. But you must not desert your guests to talk to me.
Oh, but I have to present a gentleman to you who's been asking after you for at least an hour. He says you're by far the handsomest woman present, and I agree with him.
Eugenie, please.
May I present Mr. Godfrey Wallace?
Mademoiselle.
He is one of the secretaries at the British Embassy. This is my dearest friend, Mademoiselle Buisson du Maurier.
How do you do?
And now I must return to the Duke. Forgive me, Louise. Mr. Wallace.
I understand that you speak perfect English, Mademoiselle.
I was born in London and spent my childhood there. I would be foolish indeed if I could not make myself understood in your language after that.
Ah, but I'm a Scot, and they speak purer English in Ayr than they do in Cockney London. You may have heard of my father, Sir Thomas Wallace. He lived in London until quite recently. I'm told that your father, alas, is no longer with you, but that he possessed property in Sark. Is your mother in residence at the chateau at the moment?
At the chateau? No, we are in Paris for the winter.
Ah.
That is, my mother has a minute apartment in the Rue de la Lune.
And how does life in Paris agree with you, mademoiselle? I suppose you will be visiting Portugal soon to see the Duchess in her new home. What it is to be a young lady of leisure. We poor secretaries at the embassy are kept hard at work.
But I must explain.
No explanations, I beg of you. I envy you your good fortune. May I be permitted to wait upon Madame, your mother?
Oh, I'm afraid that would not be convenient at the moment. She is preparing for a visit to Hamburg to stay with my brother Jacques, who is in business there.
I believe you have a brother who is a scientist, mademoiselle.
Well, hardly as yet. He wishes to be...
I take an intense interest in science and would much desire to make his acquaintance. Perhaps your brother would call on me at my hotel one evening. I dine at 5 o'clock, and I should be extremely happy to see him.
You are most kind, but
mademoiselle,
my brother...
I find I have so much to say in your society that I look forward to our better acquaintance. Have I your permission to write to you?
If you consider it of any advantage to you, sir.
All the advantage in the world. Oh, look, Miss Buisson, somebody is beckoning you. The Duke and Duchess must be leaving, and she would naturally wish you to see her to her carriage. May I have the honor of escorting you there?
Louise, they did not tell me you were here.
I heard you playing and didn't wish to have you disturbed.
Shh. My dear Louise, I am so glad to see you. Mother is asleep on the couch, but we can talk quietly here without disturbing her. She can still talk of nothing but the wedding.
I want to talk to you about the wedding, Ellen.
Oh. Come and sit down, my dear Louise. You obviously have something on your mind.
You remember that a Mr. Godfrey Wallace was presented to me at the reception?
Yes.
I have had a letter from him, couched in the warmest terms. He appears to want to see me again, and really I hardly know how to refuse him. He expresses himself...
I remember him conversing with you. Do you know anything of his circumstances? After all, that's the thing that matters most. A secretary at the embassy cannot have more than 300 or 400 a year at the most.
No, I suppose not.
Of course, he may have a private income. You said his father was Sir Thomas Wallace from Ayrshire?
Yes.
Oh, depend upon it, they have property there. How do you consider the prospect of living in Scotland? Oh,
but, my dear Ellen, such an idea does not enter my head. I have only met this Mr. Wallace once.
One wedding always leads to another, so they say. If he's a personal friend of the Duke of Palmella, I suppose that would be a guarantee in itself.
Oh, I hardly care about his circumstances, I must confess. I am no fortune hunter, as you know, my dear Ellen. His manner was pleasing, and I do not mind admitting to you that I should like to see him again.
Then no doubt you will contrive it. For my part, I would go carefully.
There is an indefinable something about Scotsmen. So much history, so very romantic. The pipes and the kilt. We heard them once in London. Oh, what a pity the Stuarts no longer sit on the English throne.
I know nothing derogatory to the House of Brunswick.
Oh, no. No, of course not. The position of king must be an appalling one. Such a responsibility, so difficult not to lose one's head.
So Louis the 16th seems to have found. He lost his in a basket.
Mother, how long have you been awake?
Long enough. How do you do, Louise, my dear? You're looking very pretty. What's all this about liking kilts and Scotsmen? I know a funny story about a kilt, but I daren't tell it in front of Ellen. I think a thistle came into it somewhere. Oh, Ellen, tell Gustav to bring the lamps. I want to get up.
You have not rested long enough.
Rest, fiddlesticks. Sit me up and arrange my cushions. Ah, that's better. Now, I can see you both. What a solemn-looking pair you are. You might have been quoting scripture instead of discussing a young man and his kilt. Tell me about him, Louise. I'm all of a flutter.
We were chatting of the Palmella wedding, Mrs. Clark.
Yes?
I remarked upon the pleasing manners of a Mr. Godfrey Wallace who was introduced to me. So refreshing to meet someone of breeding.
Very refreshing if he wore a kilt, I should say. Did he complain of the draught in Notre Dame?
Mother, you are deliberately misunderstanding, Louise. There was no question of Mr. Wallace wearing a kilt. He's a secretary at the embassy and the son of Sir Thomas Wallace, who has an estate in Ayr.
Very much in the Ayr, if I know anything of Scotsmen. Impecunious race, the Scots. Don't have anything to do with him. Who is his father, do you say?
Sir Thomas Wallace, now resident in London.
Never heard of him. Can make inquiries if you like. My lawyer Fladgate can find out for me.
Thank you, madame, but it's really of no consequence. I shall probably never meet Mr. Wallace again. But if I do, it will be in the Jardin du Roi for a little stroll one Sunday.
What do you want to go there for? All shrubs and no trees. Go to Versailles. Quite a forest at Versailles. Get him in a thicket and the Scotsman's yours.
Really, Mother, I must insist.
On the following Sunday, this insecure romance between Louise and Godfrey Wallace was taken a step further when Louis Mathurin arrived at his mother's apartment in the Rue de la Lune with a new friend. Someone he'd met overnight.
Louise, Adelaide.
Oh, Louis.
I present to you both my new friend, Godfrey Wallace.
Mr. Wallace.
We met only last night, but already we have sworn eternal friendship. Wallace believes with me that there is no truth except in the goddess of science. Wallace, my friend, sit down.
Thanks.
Ah, my mother's apartment is poor, but honorable.
It is really charming to meet a family who are so lacking in false pride that when they visit Paris, they live like the little Parisians. I dare swear that the contrast to the Chateau Maurier amuses you vastly.
I fear you attach a certain grandeur to us that does not exist. We are very humble people, really.
No, Miss Busson. You are one of those sweet persons who like to put poor secretaries like myself entirely at their ease. Your brother tells me that on your return to France, his late Majesty King Louis XVIII made a grant to you all as a mark of his esteem.
A trifle of no great consequence.
Perhaps not to you, Miss Busson, but to anyone else, it would no doubt appear magnificent. How I wish that you could see my home in Scotland. The wild scenery would appeal to a sensitive nature such as yours.
Does Sir Thomas vary his time between Scotland and London?
Well, no, hardly. The air of Scotland is a trifle damp. He is more generally in town.
You have visited him lately?
No, alas. We are not all free agents like yourself, Miss Busson.
Oh, I am as tied as you are. Did not Louis Mathurin explain to you that I give English lessons at a pension?
Yes, he did indeed. What a delightful eccentricity. He gave me to believe that you could not bear the life of a young lady of leisure.
Louise has little time for leisure.
Now, ladies, I beg of you to excuse me. My duties call. May I have the honor of calling on you tomorrow, Miss Busson?
I think Tuesday would be more suitable.
Then Tuesday it shall be. I take my leave with great reluctance.
I will see that you get a fiacre.
I thank you. Jusqu'à bientôt, mademoiselle.
It seems that Mr. Wallace has certain intentions towards you, Louise.
Oh, it's flattering, certainly, but rather disturbing.
Do you consider marrying him?
Adelaide. No such thing has been suggested. I'm quite at a loss.
We were in luck. There was a fiat passing the door.
I am distressed that Mr. Wallace is under a misapprehension regarding us. What have you given him to understand, Louis Maturin?
Me? I have not said anything. I happened to mention that my family possessed a chateau in Sarthe and one or two things like that. It is true that the chateau no longer exists, and I was going to tell him so, but...
I don't like this dissembling.
There is no dissembling. He seems a good fellow and knows people of influence. I thought perhaps he could get me one or two introductions. I am working very hard on an invention, as you know, and he declared himself interested. Why, Louise, do you turn up your nose at him?
On the contrary, I like him very much. I'm only afraid he will be disappointed in us.
My beloved sister, when my invention is perfected, we need none of us worry again. We will all be famous, and you will be the first to accompany me in my rocket to the moon.
And so Louise, flattered by Godfrey Wallace's seemingly excessive adoration, accepted his proposal. And in the absence of her mother in Hamburg, was married at the Eglise Suisse on the 14th of April, 1830, in spite of warnings from her more cautious friends and the fact that no proper marriage settlements had been arranged. The reception was small, partly at Louise's own request. And as soon as the health of the bride and bridegroom had been drunk, Mr. and Mrs. Godfrey Wallace left for the Hotel de Paris in the Madeleine, which was to be their temporary home. They dined alone in their rooms, and during the meal, Louise noticed that her husband's nervousness had returned.
Are you ill, my love?
No, just a slight headache. The excitement of the day, you know.
Well, then you have something on your mind.
Have I? My beloved wife, what you will think of me, I dare not say. The fact is, I'm momentarily embarrassed for money.
Oh, Godfrey.
An unlucky speculation, one thing and another. In short, at the moment, I have less than 100 francs.
100 francs?
Yes.
Do you mean that you have not sufficient for our board here?
There lies the difficulty. My intense love for you, Louise, has forced me to play this little deception. My dearest angel, I am a penniless wretch. My father disinherited me 5 years ago. I haven't a sou in the world. I must throw myself on your charity.
But Godfrey, how can I help you? My poor little annuity will never keep us both.
Oh, but you are such a capable little manager. You will do wonders. I dare say that when your chateau is fully restored, your brother will make provision for us. In the meantime, your allowance...
I'm afraid there is no question of the chateau being restored. What? It passed to other hands, and my father was unable to claim it. He died on the voyage from Dover to Calais, you see. My mother has a little income of her own, and we have been living on that. I endeavored to help by teaching English at the Pension Poussin.
But your annuity, your annuity from Louis XVIII?
I tried to tell you it was a form of courtesy, nothing more. 200 francs a year.
200 francs a year?
Yes.
But I understood you were an heiress. Mademoiselle Bisson du Maurier, with estates in Sarthe, a personal alliance from the late king. I assumed as much from your brother. And your friendship with the Duchesse de Palmilla. How do you explain that?
She was my pupil at the pension. I taught her English, and she became fond of me.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God. Oh, my God.
Godfrey, we must pray for God's guidance. He will show us the way.
Oh, don't talk that religious cant to me.
Where are you going?
Oh, I'm going out to breathe, to think. I'm going out.
Oh, Holy Mother, protect us and save us. Hail Mary, full of grace.
For 3 days, Louise remained at the hotel, pretending to herself that Godfrey Wallace would return. On the fourth day, the manager became suspicious and demanded payment for his rooms. And Louise, rather than argue with him, delved into her little savings and settled the sum. Then she drove to a convent at Versailles, where she had friends amongst the nuns, and wrote to her family, explaining what had happened. It was not until the 8th of July that a letter was brought to the convent, penned in the bold hand that she recognized too well. After a moment, she took courage and broke the seal.
Ah, Louise, your wretched husband has at last met with his merits. I have arrived at Calais, and at the instigation of your brother Louis Maturin, have been arrested and thrown in prison for no less a crime and swindling and abandoning my wife. For God's sake, write to me and endeavor to obtain the influence to release me from this base cell. and I will endeavor to atone to you for my crime.
In a fever of excitement, Louise set out for Paris. She ran round and round her little circle of friends, begging for money, until at last a sufficient sum was collected and dispatched. On the 22nd of July, Adelaide, watching for the facteur from the window in the Rue de la Lune, rushed down to the concierge and came up again with a letter bearing the Calais postmark. Louise took it from her and read it aloud.
My ever lovely Louise, I am at the moment about to embark for England.
I have this morning been liberated
at your instigation with the money you sent.
At three this afternoon, I leave this accursed land of France forever. I will write on my arrival in London. And until then, I am ever your sincere lover and husband, G. Wallace.
Oh, at last I know. I shall never see him again. Never.
At this moment, a letter came from the Duchess of Palmela, begging her dearest Louise to come to Portugal to be present at the birth of her first child. She went at once, glad to be rid of Paris and its memories. During the weeks that followed, Mrs. Clark, through her lawyer in London, continued the search for the missing bridegroom. Word came that Wallace had enlisted in the service of the East India Company and was now in India. From Portugal, Louise wrote to her brother, begging him to call on Mrs. Clark to thank her for the trouble she'd taken. So Louis Maturin set forth one September afternoon, knowing very little of the Clarks, and having only a vague memory of a painted, overdressed old lady he'd seen only once. He had no recollection whatsoever of the daughter. As he climbed the stairs to their apartment, he was aware of music borne down to him from the landing above. Someone was playing Schubert's Serenade, and on a harp. Half-consciously, he began to hum, turning the handle of the door as he did so, and walked straight into the apartment without thinking, never waiting for the servant to introduce him. Ellen Clark looked up and ceased playing, as if the silence had brought him back to reality. He stopped humming, bowed.
Miss Clark, Louise never told me you were a musician. How many hours I have wasted when I might have known.
I saw you at the wedding. You must be Louise's brother, Louis Maturin.
Music has spared us the absurd formality of introduction.
Louise has often told me about you. Firstly, you were a singer, and now you're a scientist, neither of which Louise really approved of. And also you were an atheist, which frightened her.
Louise should have been a nun. She does not exist in the world at all.
Were you not brought up as a Catholic?
Of course I was. That's why I'm an atheist. Catholics are persecutors of philosophy and free thinking.
I'm inclined to agree with you. But then I never had any religion at all.
We shall agree famously, then. We are both free thinkers and we adore music. What do you know of science?
Very little, but I desire to know more.
You have a Roman face. How old are you, I wonder?
2 years younger than Louise.
Then you are the same age as myself. Ha! We become more and more alike. And you spent your childhood in England, as I did, and you grew up in France, even as myself. Why, we may even have travelled here on the same boat.
We left England in the March of 1810.
So did we. But this is amazing. What a coincidence. Why has Louise never told me all this?
We have never discussed it.
And you have known her for 10 years, and I have known you for 2 minutes, and already understand you better. I shall visit you often. Do you mind? Now Louise has gone to Portugal, there is no one to listen to me when I talk about myself.
I will listen, but I will also talk.
Better and better. Oh, here is the letter from Louise addressed to Mrs. Clark. Will you open it?
No. My mother dearly loves a letter. She has so few these days.
Ellen, who are you prattling to?
God save my soul. Is this your mother?
Oh, I know who you are. You are Louise's brother. The family likeness is ridiculous. Where have you been hiding? Why have we never seen you before?
Madame, the loss is entirely mine. When Louise mentioned the Clarks, she omitted to tell me that Miss Ellen possessed a sister. You are she, I presume.
None of your nonsense, Mr. Busson. You're quizzing me, I know. How'd you like me gone?
I had not noticed it. The wearer holds my attention.
Damn me, what a lie you are. What have you both been talking about?
Madame, we discovered that we are affinities. Born in the same year with the same tastes.
She's a good daughter, Mr. Busson. I wouldn't part with her for the world. Only for a rich husband with several thousands a year.
Perhaps Miss Clark would have something to say in the matter.
Miss Clark would much rather not be discussed at all.
You've a fine voice, Mr. Button. I heard you just now. You ought to train for opera.
I intended to, but there were family obstacles.
With your appearance, you'd have made a fortune. What is your profession, then?
I dabble in science, madame. I invent machines. I am engaged on a miraculous machine that will carry us all to the moon.
To the moon? What would you do when you got there?
Well, that, madame, I must confess, had not occurred to me. No doubt we will explore the territory, come upon strange beasts, strange men even.
Strange men, me foot. If they were made any different, I shouldn't know what to do with them.
Ah, but Mrs. Clark, what fun it would be finding out. Huh?
And so Louis Mathurin became a frequent visitor to the Clark's apartment, while Ellen suddenly discovered how lonely she'd been before he became her companion. Men had never shown an interest in her before. They came to the house to be amused by the mother. But a month after their first meeting, Ellen entered her mother's room in a state of great excitement and told her that Louis Mathurin had proposed. The marriage took place at the British Embassy in 1831, attended by both families, and Ellen and her husband left for a honeymoon in Brittany. Mrs. Clark returned to London on the arm of her son George, lately back home with his regiment from India. Ellen and Louis Mathurin's first son was born in 1834 and was named Georges Louis Palmella du Maurier. Palmella as a compliment to the distinguished friend of his Aunt Louise. Shortly after, though, Louise in Lisbon received two letters from Paris. One from her brother told her of the birth. The other, forwarded from her mother's house, bore an Indian stamp. She opened it with a sense of foreboding.
Bombay, 1834. Madam, I have the unpleasant duty of informing you that Mr. Godfrey Wallace died at this place in September last. It was his last request that I should inform you of it. Some obstacles arose which prevented me from carrying out until now this afflicting duty. I am, Madam, your most obedient servant, H. Elgan, Clark, East India Company.
In the cold finality of her husband's death, Louise's thoughts turned to her young, newly born nephew, and she prayed for the dead and for one just beginning to live. The Buisson du Maurier's had an apartment on the first floor at number 80 in the Champs-Élysées, and with Ellen's allowance from her mother and Louis Mathurin's occasional contributions, they managed to live in reasonable comfort.
Chagrin d'amour dure toute la vie.
Ellen, I must away to the laboratory. Time is pressing.
I hope your new invention will progress today.
Of course it will. Give me some of the housekeeping money, my love. I will return it to you directly I get my loan back from DuPont.
You should not lend money to your friends. It is a very bad principle.
I know.
Besides, we cannot afford it.
I know, dear heart, but I can never refuse a loan. I cannot hurt a fellow's feelings.
My purse is on that side table.
I met a man earlier this morning. In fact, we had a little refreshment in the cafe. And it appears that he has an uncle who has a very influential friend who would be just the person to show a practical interest in my invention.
You spend too much of your mornings in these cafes.
Ah, that is where you are mistaken. More business is done in a cafe than ever is done in an office.
Oh, my letter this morning was from Mother, suggesting that we cross to England to stay with her at a house in Sussex.
No. What do you think of it?
As my brother George is to be George Palmella's godfather, I consider it would be suitable to have the christening in England.
If christened he must be, let it be in England. And your mother will no doubt find me a suitable patron for my portable lamp, on which I have spent so much time.
I name this child George Louis Palmella.
Well, Ellen, my dear, a damn fine christening. Everyone was there, and the county dames who have been looking askance at Mama consider her role as a grandmother most becoming.
Yes, George. Or should I call you Captain Clark?
Oh, my promotion is so recent that I can never have enough of the title. Well, I'm due for foreign service again before long, and the problem is, what is to become of Mother?
Our mother has remarkable powers of survival.
Why not live over here with her? The country air will be extremely beneficial to the child, and you would have an English nurse. I may as well tell you I haven't much desire to see my nephew grow into a Frenchman.
How can we live in England when Louis Mathurin has his work in Paris?
Oh, my dear sister, I have no wish to hurt your feelings, and I have the utmost regard for Louis. Only, what exactly is his work?
He has his laboratory, and he was working on a new invention just before we left.
And the rocket to the moon idea.
I had not heard him mention it lately.
There was some technical difficulty. Of course, our problem is always the same. No capital, no backing behind any enterprise.
Do you find you can manage comfortably on the allowance Mother makes you?
Sometimes it is a little difficult. Louis is a child in many ways. He does not seem to understand the value of money.
I thought he understood it very well. Since you have been here, he has borrowed £20 off me.
Why, I'm sorry, George. You shall have the money at the end of the month when my allowance is due.
Oh, nonsense, nonsense. I don't wish to hurt your feelings. But living as you do, you should manage very well on your allowance. But when it comes to supporting your husband as well, that is another matter. However, do not let us talk of it again. But if you are ever in want, my dear, write privately to me.
Ellen, George, look at this letter. Palmella has been made ambassador to Brussels. He and the whole family are leaving Lisbon in June when he goes to take up his appointment. What a splendid thing for them all. This appointment of Palmella's has come at a most opportune time. We must profit by the occasion.
You mean that we shall be in close touch again with Louis?
Partly that, but in other ways too. Wouldn't you like to take George Palmella to Brussels to see his namesake? They are very fond of science in Brussels. What an opportunity it would be.
In May, the Boussin du Maurier's returned to Paris, and Louis Mathurin departed to Brussels to interest the Duke of Palmella in his new inventions. In his absence, Ellen found that she was once more pregnant, and when the Duchess of Palmella wrote informing her that Louis Mathurin would have a position in the Duke's suite and that her friend Louise would be with her at the birth of the child, she decided to join her husband. They moved from Paris at the end of the summer. In February of 1836, their second son, Alexandre Eugène, was born and was christened Gigi by his small brother, who himself had earned the nickname of Kiki. And in 1839, their daughter Isabella. Exactly what services Louis Mathurin had rendered to the Duke of Palmella, it would be difficult to say. But when the ambassador was recalled to Lisbon, Louise accompanied the family in her capacity of governess, while the Boussin du Maurier's returned to France to stay with Mrs. Clark at Boulogne. Mrs. Clark was in the midst of hatching a plot which was to be a great worry and disturbance to her daughter.
Come in, Ellen. Don't stand there frowning at me. What's the thundercloud for this morning?
Mother, it has come to my knowledge that you are thinking of publishing your memoirs.
And how did you come by this knowledge? Prying into my correspondence, I'll be bound.
Certainly not. An open letter from your lawyer, Mr. Fladgate, was in my papers this morning.
Oh.
It must have reached there by mistake.
And you read it?
I would not have dreamed of doing so had not a word caught my attention.
Oh.
It seems that you are threatening to publish some letters from the late Duke of York unless his brother Cambridge is willing to buy them.
You must have had a good read.
It is blackmail.
That's as may be. I have a publisher in London who is craving for the book, with the letters, of course. And he says it'll have a tremendous sale. We'll all be rich. And life will be a little less dull than it has been these past years.
You know very well that the express terms of the annuity were that all the old letters should be returned and destroyed.
Damn the annuity. It isn't enough.
Mr. Fladgate suggests that the royal solicitors will cancel the annuity if you continue with this wicked action.
I'll do what I like with my own money.
But it is not your own money. That annuity is held in trust for me and my children.
It's about time that your husband found a way of supporting his family.
I am not insensible of that. But it is not his fault that his inventions are not recognized.
Oh.
And what of George? Do you realize that he would have to hand in his papers, give up the army?
You're working yourself into a fine lather, me girl.
God knows I do not want money for myself.
No.
I have never spent a penny of my allowance on anything but necessities. But to see the annuity, the only thing that stands between us and complete and utter poverty, thrown away through a spate of ill humor and false pride.
Oh.
No, it's too much. It's too unkind.
Oh, now. Well, perhaps I'll have another think. You gave me all hot and breathless. You'd better open the windows. It's bitter outside, but not as bad as it is in here.
Ellen!
What are you doing here, Louis Mathurin? We thought you were in Paris.
I was, but I left as soon as I could to tell you the news. What's the matter?
Nothing.
Oh, Ellen's overtired.
Why did you not send word that you were coming?
I wanted to inform you myself. A group of people are interested in my portable lamp. A company has been formed, the patent taken out, and now I have come to take Ellen and the boys back to Paris.
What?
I have taken an apartment in the Rue de Passy, and we are going to be rich.
Rich?
Oh, at least I hope so. And you, ma belle mère, are going to rule Paris as once you reigned over London. That is when you can tear yourself away from Boulogne, which of course we don't want you to do until you feel that you are quite ready.
Life in the Rue de Passy was pleasant enough. The Dumouriez had friends and acquaintances in the Quartier and further afield in the Faubourg Saint-Germain. There, in particular, a Madame Rosio held soirees for the intellectual members of her circle. And at these, Louis Mathurin was in his element, prophesying the wildest successes for science in the world to come, and for himself in particular. One afternoon in June of 1844, at the particular request of Madame Rosio, Louis Mathurin and his family came to the house in the Faubourg Saint-Germain to make the acquaintance of Madame Rosio's mother, Madame Duval, who had journeyed to Paris from Sartre to visit her daughter. Madame Duval, who was 80 years of age, seemed to take an intense interest in Louis Mathurin and his family as they entered the room.
Maman, may I present Monsieur and Madame Busson-Dumaurier? These are their sons, George and Eugène, but we call them Kiki and Gigi, and this is their small daughter, Isabella.
Oh, I am delighted to make your acquaintances.
Isabella, curtsy to Madame Duval.
Oui, Maman.
Oh, how prettily she does it. I remember my own mother instructing me to curtsy to His Majesty Louis XV, oh, so many years ago. It was at our glass foundry at La Pierre.
Ah, that is most interesting, madame. I've always understood that my father was a gentleman glassblower, known several foundries before the revolution.
Your father emigrated to England.
At the outbreak of the revolution, he followed the example of the clergy and the aristocracy and took his young bride, my mother, to England. And suffered much penury in consequence.
Your mother, tell me, was she good to you?
Oh, yes, the best in the world. Oh. She had a hard struggle after my father left us in 1802. He died tragically on his way back to France, you see.
Monsieur Busson, or Dumouriez, please give me your hand.
Madame?
Forgive me, but I have every reason to believe that you are my nephew.
Nephew?
Ah, the son of my eldest brother, Robert Mathurin.
I'm afraid I don't understand. I met Madame Rosio only just over 2 weeks ago. I had not the pleasure of her acquaintance before.
Yes, I know just how you met, but she was too overwhelmed when she learnt your name and your history to tell you that her maiden name was Busson and that her uncle was Robert Mathurin Busson, a master glass engraver who emigrated to England.
No.
However, she wrote to tell me all these things, and that is why I am here now. Yes. Yes, you have your father's eyes, his hair, the quick tilt of the head. You are Robert in the flesh. Oh, my dear boy, I have waited for this moment for 50 years.
But the name Busson, I was brought up to understand that we were descended from an ancient Breton family, that my father became a master glassblower merely for his own amusement. Do you mean to tell me that none of this is true?
Oh, your father was, first and foremost, the most incorrigible farceur that I have ever known. If he invented these tales, it suited his purpose at the time.
But the Chateau Le Maurier, the chateau that was burnt to the ground by the peasants during the revolution.
A farmhouse, unchanged since your father was born there in 1749. We have cousins there still.
There must be some misunderstanding. My mother can have known nothing of this unless she... Oh, my sister is companion to the Duchess of Palmela in Lisbon. My brother Jacques is in business in Hamburg. I myself, with the help of influential friends, intend placing on the markets of the world a lamp of my own invention. We have great hopes.
You are an optimist like your father. So much the better. It makes life comparatively easy.
Oh, tell me about him. I must know everything, even if he was not born in the chateau, as you say.
He did not die on the voyage back to France. That was another man whose identity and papers he assumed for certain reasons.
What?
He died in 1811 in Tours, a poor but honorable schoolmaster.
Ah, I see. Oh, my poor father.
I am sorry, Madame Dumouriez, if all this distresses you.
On the contrary, madame, I feel that we are on firmer, safer ground.
Ah, and this is your eldest son. How old are you, Kiki?
I am 10 already.
Ooh, quite an age. And what do you intend to do when you grow up?
My father hopes that I'll become a chemist, but I don't like chemistry very much. I like to draw, most of all.
Then, if you are good at it, you must draw. Louis Mathurin, I wish to make a gift to your son, Kiki. It is his right of inheritance. Zoe, my dear, please hand me that leather case that I placed on the table.
Here, Mama.
There. This is the crystal goblet, made in the foundry of La Pierre Coudrisseau and engraved by my father, Mathurin Busson, on the occasion of the visit of King Louis XV. My father used to say that as long as it remained treasured in the family, the creative talent of the Bussons would continue in some form or another through succeeding generations. This glass, Kiki, is for you.
Oh, thank you, Madame.
Remain true to your talent, and the glass will bring you luck. Abuse your talent or neglect it, and the luck will run out of the glass and spill all around you. Tomorrow, I shall return to my house at Gay Delaunay to prepare for your visit to me. I will tell you then the truth of your heritage, of which there is much that is fine, much that is beautiful, and in which you may take pride.
In the years from 1844 to 1851, many things occurred to alter the lives of the Dumouriez. After the death of the Duchess of Palmela in childbirth, Louise returned to France from Lisbon and made a home for herself in the convent at Versailles. In 1847, Kiki and Gigi went to school at the Pension Froissart, and the family moved from Passy to the Rue du Bac. George Clark had left the English army and was living with his mother in Boulogne. He was a frequent visitor to Paris, and there in his sister's house, he and Louise met frequently. In the spring of 1851, Louise was bidden by Ellen to the Rue du Bac for a very special reason.
Dear Louise, I asked you to come today especially, as George is in Paris and is coming here at 6 o'clock.
Oh, it will be delightful to see him again.
He tells me he has news of great importance.
What can it be?
Has it not struck you, Louise, that George has always paid you a considerable amount of attention when you've been together here?
He has always been very courteous.
George has never been one of these compliment-paying gallants. But I thought it very odd that he questioned you so closely on marriage. Of course, he knows your sad misfortune in the old days. But it looked to me as if he were making some allusion to the future. Did he commit himself in any way?
He remarked that it was not until a man had reached years of discretion, as he had, that he could know his own mind. He said something about 55 being the prime of life.
Did he really? I should call that very significant.
People of our age, he told me, need sympathy and love. And did I not agree, and was I not lonely at the convent?
My dear Louise, that practically amounts to a proposal.
Ellen, do you think so? Really, I have never considered such a possibility at my time of life, with my rheumatism and one thing and another. Why, Ellen, I hardly think I could accept.
Nonsense, Louise, it would be just the thing for you. I'm sure George would not presume upon you in any way just because you were his wife.
Oh, as to that, I am sure that I am quite as capable of fulfilling the duties of a wife as anybody else. I am not suggesting that I could have children.
No, naturally. I understand perfectly to what you're referring.
After all, I should need no preparation. I'm not like a young girl who must have a trousseau. All my things are in good order. A new nightgown or two, perhaps.
You seem quite prepared to accept him.
I have a great regard for your brother, and I believe I could make him happy.
That is what I feel. There is no need to tell you how happy it would make all of us. I will say nothing to Louis until George tells him himself.
Captain Clark, madame.
Thank you, Charlotte.
Ellen, my dear, my dear. And Mr. Moyer, what good fortune indeed.
I have been expecting you. But Louise and I have been gossiping, and I had no idea it was already 6 o'clock.
Well, I'm a little in advance. Impatient, you know. But I'm so glad that Mr. Moyer is here. Ellen, have I your permission to make a statement of great importance?
You have indeed.
Well, then, here goes. I'm going to be married.
Oh, George! We have been expecting this for some time, and we think you have made the best possible choice.
Ellen,
But wait until you see her.
See her?
Georgie, my sweetest heart, come in and be introduced.
Oh.
Let me present to you Miss Georgina Lewis, the future Mrs. George Clark.
But Miss Lewis...
is a young girl. Is that what you were going to say? Well, she's not too young to know what she's doing. Damn it, she's 19.
Please forgive me. We are all very pleased to make your acquaintance, Miss Lewis.
Oh, dearest Mrs. Du Maurier, call me Georgie, please.
Please sit down, Miss Georgie. Mm. Charlotte will bring us tea this instant.
Dear Mrs. Du Maurier, how wonderful to meet you.
This is my sister-in-law, Mademoiselle Louise Bousson Du Maurier.
How do you do?
Oh, George has talked often of you and said you had been like another sister to him.
Georgina and I met her a year ago in India. Mm. She came out to be with her brother in the regiment. And we gave a dance for her 18th birthday. Of course, I didn't have a look in. The young fellows swarmed round her like bees round a honeypot.
Oh, George, dear, don't be naughty. The ladies will think me a great flirt.
And so you were, and so you were. And then her horse ran away with her. Don't blame him at all. And the old fogey, that's me, rescued her and brought her back, and after that, she didn't think I was quite so ancient.
George is so powerful, so strong.
No, no, dear, don't overdo it. To cut a long story short, we became good friends. She came home to England, I went to Boulogne. We corresponded, and I took Mama into my confidence, and Mama asked her to stay. And the day before yesterday, she made me the happiest man on earth.
Of course, your angelic Mama, Mrs. Du Maurier, has been our good angel. She is just the sweetest person in the world. I positively dote on her. George gets quite jealous, don't you, my love?
Ellen, if you will excuse me, I must take my leave. There are so many things that I have to do, and...
I understand that you reside at Versailles, mademoiselle.
In a convent, Miss Lewis.
Oh.
Captain Clark, I wish every happiness to you and to your bride-to-be. You are both very fortunate.
Mr. Moyer.
Louise, I will see you.
Ellen, I would prefer not. I shall communicate in a short time. Goodbye.
George Clark and Georgina Lewis were married in May, and Louise's tears were shed unheard within the walls of her convent room. Ellen went up to Boulogne for the wedding, taking the 12-year-old Isabella to be a bridesmaid. Louis Mathurin was in London, still canvassing his inventions, and on her return to Paris, Ellen found her son Kiki, now aged 17, in a state of apprehension and distress.
What is this you are telling me, Kiki?
That I have failed at the Sorbonne in the written part of the Latin section.
After all the encouragement you have had from Papa and myself, and no expense spared over your education? Who is going to employ you now without a degree? What sort of position do you expect to take up in the scientific world? No doubt you think it very amusing.
Oh, Mama, how can you say that? You surely do not think that I wanted to fail the examination.
I don't know what to think. Of course, I know what it is. It's all this drawing.
But, Mama, I only sketch for my own amusement.
Exactly. For amusement. You fail in your exams because you prefer amusing yourself with a pencil and generally at other people's expense. Don't think that I did not catch a glimpse of that caricature of your Uncle George the other day, because I did. A nice tribute to a godfather who made you a handsome present of 20 francs before he went away.
Oh, Mama, please stop.
I am not going to tell your papa. You will have to break the news to him yourself. A fine surprise it will be to him when he greets you in London, after all the worries he has there already.
Mama, wouldn't it be better if I wrote to him and did not go to London?
Certainly not. It was arranged that you should go on the 15th, and on the 15th you shall go. It is extremely possible that we shall all live in London. His business prospects appear brighter there than here. It would be a good thing for Isabella, at any rate. I shall take care that she goes to a good college.
But what about Gigi, Mama?
Well, Gigi will have to stay in France. Your Aunt Louise will make herself responsible for him. Now it is time you went to bed. I have had an exhausting day. My head is splitting. When you go, the steamer will take you direct to London Bridge, and Papa will be there to meet you.
Papa! Papa!
Gigi!
Papa! Why are you waving that ridiculous umbrella? And scarlet, too.
Because it cheers one up. It's like Paris.
Out she comes.
Good. They've got the gangway up. Come ashore. Come ashore.
Oh, my boy, it's good to see you. But why are you looking so miserable?
Papa.
Now, you needn't tell me. I can see it. You failed. Don't worry, it doesn't matter. We'll go and have some dinner and forget all about it. Oh, great of my make way there, make way.
Have you seen Froggy?
Oh, great of my love.
In the same year, the family crossed from France and went to live at number 44 Wharton Street in Pentonville, all except Gigi, who in due course joined the French army. In 1852, old Mrs. Clark died, and the annuity became Ellen's. This improved matters, and Louis Mathurin was the first to take advantage of it.
I shall install Kiki in a laboratory of his own. I've had my eye on such a place for some time in Barge Yard, Bucklersbury.
Papa, don't think me ungrateful, but please believe me when I tell you that I shall never make a chemist. Let me do anything but chemistry.
Nonsense, my boy. If I can succeed, so can you.
We have yet to see your successes, Louis.
Oh, you may scorn me, but you may remember that my lamp has had many sales.
Many is not a living.
And you will be surprised and delighted, I hope, to hear that I have had some lucky ventures on the stock exchange.
Louis, you are not gambling again. You will ruin us.
On the contrary, I am able to offer the family extra advantages, including this laboratory for Kiki.
You should use the money for yourself.
And indeed, you may well be in need of it since you have this wretched lawsuit pending.
Oh, my friends will help me. It is a monstrous imposition on my integrity, this argument about patents. The invention is purely mine.
It will need money to prove that.
If I cannot raise the necessary amounts here, I shall go to France, where I am certain that I shall find aid. Louise will do everything she can.
And to France he went, where Louise did all she was able to do, even to securing a contribution from the Duke of Palmella on the grounds of old friendship. But when Louis Mathurin returned to England, the lawsuit dragged on and on until he was exhausted, and he reaped no benefit from an arranged settlement. In 1856, his health began to fail, and with it, his courage and his gaiety. And in June, he was desperately ill, and developed a melancholia entirely foreign to his nature.
What are you thinking of, Papa?
Huh? Life, Kiki. So sad. Simone. I've lost everything. Courage. And hope. I feel alone. Alone.
But we are with you always. Mama, Isabella, and I. We'll never leave you.
I don't mean that sort of loneliness. You are growing up, Kiki, but you cannot quite understand.
I understand that if we'd stayed in France, this would never have happened. Ever since we came to London, there have been difficulties and worries and, oh, nothing has gone well.
No, no, they were there before, but they did not matter. Please put another pillow under my head.
Oh, of course. There. I have had a letter from Gigi, Papa.
Mm.
He says he would like to come to London to see us all.
Yes.
It has been such a long time. Aunt Louise would like to come too, but the journey is long and would be too arduous for her.
What does her mother say to all this?
She doubts if we could afford his board and lodging.
Kiki, will you please come downstairs for a moment? I want to speak to you.
Yes, Mama. What can Mama want?
I'd better go and see, my boy. I feel tired. So tired.
The doctor has just gone, Kiki. He spoke with me a long time after he left your father. He thinks there is probably an hereditary tendency to severe melancholia. And he suggests calling in a specialist at once.
A specialist? Can we afford that?
We must. He also thinks that your father should be removed to a quiet nursing home where he would have the proper care and attention due to his state.
You don't mean a mental home?
He said it was a special place trained to deal with these cases. We can't send your papa away. He's like a poor, puzzled child sitting up there in bed staring at the sky. He's always been a child from the very beginning of our married life.
Darling Mama, of course we won't send him away. If he gets worse, I can look after him. I can be his nurse. He will get better, Mama. I'm certain he'll get better.
He was always so generous, so reckless. If only he'd been more thoughtful, we would not be living here now.
Were none of his inventions successful then?
Only the portable lamp brought in a little money. Oh, I've had so many worries in my life, so much anxiety. Even in Paris, there was always this endless struggle against poverty.
It never seemed to me that we were poor. We always had plenty to eat and such good food, too. You helping us to soup à la bonne femme out of a large tureen. And then suddenly Papa would come in with his cape flung over his shoulders like a cavalier and his silk hat on his head. And I used to think that it was so beautiful that I would burst into tears.
Did that all happen, Kiki? I have no memory left. You have all the imagination of the family.
Oh, Mama, we were happy then. Whatever you like to say.
Perhaps. Oh, this sultry weather. It's so hot in the house. I think I'll go out for a little while. I may call in to see Dr. Harvey and explain to him that we cannot bear the idea of your father going to a home. Besides, we could not afford it. Will you stay here and listen for Papa?
Yes, Mama. Don't look so sad.
I will try not to. I will not be long.
Mama is right. It is hot.
What is that?
Papa! It can't be. He hasn't sung for months.
Oh, he's better. He's better.
Oh, Papa, I heard you below. He was singing again. Oh, this is wonderful beyond words. Come away from the window. We must get back into bed. Papa. Papa, what is it? What has happened? I'll lift you up. There. Oh, that's better. Papa, come back to bed. Papa, why don't you speak? Why are you staring at me? Oh, no. Papa, you can't have died. But I'm here. It's Kiki. Oh, no, no, no. Oh, no.
Of Louis Matrin's sudden death has naturally been a great shock to you, Ellen. But now that he is no longer with us, you must look to the future. And as your brother, I shall do everything in my power to aid. Have you any plans?
We shall give up this house as soon as possible. Kiki has no wish to remain in London. I do not care where I go.
And what does Kiki intend to do?
I shall dispose of the laboratory and go to Paris to study art.
My dear fellow, you may have a certain talent with your pencil, I don't deny it, but to make art your profession is another matter. It'll be years before you make any money.
I can't help that. It's the only thing I care about and the only thing I can do.
May I ask what you propose to do about your mother?
Mama will come and live with me. Her little income will be enough to keep us. As soon as I earn a sou, I shall pay for my board, of course.
Ellen, does this idea meet with your approval?
I really do not see what else we can do. Kiki is not really fitted for chemistry. In spite of all the money and patience poor Louis and I have spent on him. He can draw, we know that. I could not possibly let him go and live in Paris by himself. And as you know, George, we can live for next to nothing over there.
And Isabella?
Kiki has suggested that she should go as a paying guest to the parents of her great friend Emma Whitewick. Of course, the father's in trade, but they're a very good sort of people.
She will always be welcome with us at Milford for the holidays. Has anyone heard from Eugene? Gigi, as you call him?
He has not yet had time to reply to Kiki's letter. But we imagine that he will continue in the army as before. There is an alternative that Isabella should come to France as well.
It would be much better if you and Isabella were parted for a time. You get on each other's nerves. You, Mama, nag at her continually, with the result that she becomes impertinent and foolish just to annoy you. I don't dream all the time, you know. I observe people sometimes.
Hardly the way to speak to your mother, all the same.
Uncle George, Papa is dead now. And as his eldest son, I step into his place.
This is a surprising tone coming from you.
You have been extremely considerate and generous to us all over a number of years, and I can't thank you enough. But if there is any decision to be made regarding my family, the final word will be with me.
My dear boy, I have not the slightest desire to interfere. Naturally, your mother consults me as her legal representative. Your father has left a number of debts. Until they are settled, you can't, any of you, have an extra penny. So I hope, for your sake, you make yourself independent with your paintbrush as soon as possible.
I shall hope to do so.
Well, Ellen, I have a train to catch. You and Isabella will, of course, make Milford your home until you come to a settled decision regarding the future. Georgina and I will be delighted to have you. No. Don't see me out, Ellen. I am quite capable of finding my way. Remember, we expect you and Isabella at Milford.
Oh, I'm sorry, Mama, if I appeared contrary with Uncle George.
It is no matter. It was rather pointed that he did not invite you to Milford as well as us. I'm afraid he has not got over that silly little flirtation between you and Georgina when you were staying there last year.
Well, as you know, Mama, it was nothing. We were both younger than Uncle George, and Wales can be very boring, especially when it rains.
It rains in Paris, too, sometimes.
But in Paris, the rain dances, and there is always something to do. There is even work to do.
The lease of Wharton Street was disposed of successfully. Ellen and Isabella went to Milford, and Kiki caught the Boulogne steamer at London Bridge, as he'd longed to do so often during those 6 months of exile in Pentonville. The smell of France invaded his nostrils as soon as he stepped ashore at Boulogne. And when his train drew into the platform in Paris, and there was the same noise, the same incredible confusion, Kiki could have burst into tears. He returned to his father's old rooms in the Faubourg Poissonnière and went to study painting at the Académie Glière in the Rue Notre-Dame des Poitiers Saint-Michel. He made numerous companions of all nationalities. His best friends were Tom Armstrong, older than himself, Lamont, Rowley, Pointer, and Aleko Ionides, as well as the slightly sinister Jimmy Whistler, who wore his dark curls long and was a great poseur. When Ellen arrived in September, she was surprised to find him surrounded by so many young men. He'd never shown himself particularly sociable in London. There was no doubt that he'd found his vocation at last. In the April of the following year, Kiki decided that life in Paris was too easy, and so he decided to go to the Academy at Antwerp, under the direction of de Keyser, with the well-known Van Lirius as art master. In Antwerp, one could live even cheaper than in Paris. And as his mother was agreeable, he took up residence in the spring, while she went back to England to visit Isabella. It was not until August that the first shadow appeared. In the studio one morning, he and the other students were painting the head of an old man from life under the eye of their master Van Lirius, when suddenly, Kiki put his hand over his left eye, then gave a little gasp.
Dumouriez, what is the matter?
Monsieur Van Lirius, I do not know.
Let me see your sketching. Yes, very good. But that line of the left cheek is out of balance, you see?
No.
But, my dear Dumouriez, it's obvious.
I cannot see at all.
What do you mean?
When I cover my left eye, the model returns to normal. But when I shut my right eye and look with my left, I cannot see anything at all. I cannot see my companions around me.
This is extraordinary. How long have you known this?
Not at all until this morning. Hmm. For the last few weeks, I have felt tired and have had headaches at night. Sometimes so bad that I could not sleep. Now I know what they mean. I'm going blind. I shall never be able to paint again.
Now we must not exaggerate. You have sight, perfect in one eye. We must see how the other can be restored. One of the finest eye specialists in Belgium lives in Louvain. I will give you his address. You will write to him and he will make an appointment for you to go there and see him. There's no need to despair, none at all.
Well, Monsieur de Moyer, as far as I can tell, there's very little wrong with your eye. A little congestion of the retina, but I will give you a prescription. And I would also suggest that you use dark glasses for a while. Most important of all, don't worry. Go away to the sea for a month and come and see me directly you return.
Kiki took a ticket to Blankenberg, a village by the sea not far from Ostend, and stayed there a month, talking to no one, and feeling that his eye was becoming worse. He returned to Antwerp in very low spirits, and awaited his second visit to Louvain and the specialist's findings.
I am afraid, Monsieur de Maurier, that things have not improved. There is a slight detachment of the retina which will not stand any undue strain.
What am I to do?
You must have treatment at least once a week. And you must give up all thought of work for several months. Have you anyone to look after you?
No. My family is in England. Perhaps my mother would come out and take charge for me.
Then I advise you to communicate with her immediately.
Your letter only reached me at Milford 5 days ago. I came post-haste. I am horrified, my dear boy. You're thin and pale and shaking with nerves.
I'm sorry, Mama, but I cannot help it.
If only I had stayed to look after you, this would never have happened. It all comes about through neglect. You say this doctor is in Louvain?
Yes.
Then we must move nearer. You cannot go every week from Antwerp to Louvain. It is too expensive. And then there are the consultation fees as well.
There is a place called Malines, which is nearer. And I believe one can live there very cheaply.
Then to Malines we will go. You will be able to benefit from the country air, and there will be no distractions, and you will be able to rest.
Malines was a depressing town, full of churches and priests with long faces, set in a flat, uninteresting countryside. The long winter months dragged on, with no substantial improvement in Kiki's condition. Even his right eye seemed to be failing, and in his despair, he harbored thoughts of suicide. At his lowest ebb, he returned home one evening.
Kiki? Is that you, Kiki? Come in and sit down. What is the matter? Is anything wrong?
No, I'm just tired.
Well, sit down and listen to this letter from Isabella. Such good news! She says that Mrs. Whitewick was in the train the other day and met a lady who had just come back from consulting a celebrated German oculist in a little village near Dusseldorf. This lady was completely cured by his treatment. Also, there is an excellent school of painting in Dusseldorf itself. Now, what do you think of that?
It could be a miracle. May I see the letter?
Here it is. Of course, we could not undertake a journey of that kind without consulting your Uncle George. But I do not think he would refuse to advance us the money.
No. You have dropped something from your lap, Mama. Hmm? It's on the floor. What is it?
Why, that is Emma Whitewick's likeness that Isabella enclosed with her own. I must say that Emma has grown into a very handsome young woman. Very superior looking to her parents.
She is beautiful. Such a lovely expression. What age is she?
18, I believe.
When I last saw her, she was only about 12. Yes, Mama. Let us go to Dusseldorf. Oh, I'd like to get my eyesight back so that I can see her face as it truly is.
In the late spring of 1859, Ellen and Kiki moved to Dusseldorf. The day after they arrived, Kiki went to Grafrath to consult the famous oculist.
That will do, Mr. de Maurier. Yes. Well, I am sorry to have to tell you that the sight in the left eye is gone forever.
Oh, no.
No. Don't be too upset. The inflammation will go down and the pain will not return. Your right eye is perfectly sound. If you care to have treatment with me here, I can promise you will be a different man.
Oh, Herr Professor, you cannot imagine what your words mean to me.
And in a little while, you should be able to start painting again. I understand that you are a painter.
Well, I try. Oh, if this is true, it would be the miracle my mother has prayed for.
As long as the light is good and the hours not too long, it would be far better for you to be employed. Goodbye, Mr. de Maurier. We will get you well, never fear.
Oh, thank you, Herr Doctor. I will not worry. Ever, ever.
And Kiki went back to Dusseldorf, treading on air. The season was just beginning, and it seemed so gay and amusing after Malines. Without knowing how it happened, he was plunged into the little Dusseldorf society, hobnobbing with the German princes of the blood and dubious counts and so-called barons and down-at-heel captains living on pensions. Nearly all of them thought Kiki a delightful young fellow and most talented with his pencil. By the end of the summer, Kiki was well enough to start painting again. He made no progress in oil, but his facility for sketching grew. Life was gay, his health was improving, there were studio parties, and he always had many friends. However, at Easter in 1860, Kiki felt a feeling of responsibility towards the future. His only money came from his mother's annuity, and this both worried him and curtailed his activities. The arrival of Tom Armstrong, a friend from the Paris days, was an opportunity for Kiki to air his forebodings.
My dear Tom, I shall never be a painter. The first study I ever painted in Antwerp is a Titian compared to the oily abominations I perpetrate today.
You ought to go in for illustrating. I'm convinced that is your true métier. Have a look at this.
What is it?
Punch's Almanac. See what you think of the work of Charles Keane and John Leach. They're both on the Punch staff. Isn't that the sort of thing more in your line?
My dear old fellow, why has nobody ever told me of this paper before? It's the best thing I've ever seen.
It's achieved a great following in London.
By Jove, these chaps can draw. What I'd give to be as good as them.
I believe you could be if you'd only try that instead of going on with your painting. Come back to London with me and we'll take the plunge together. You're wasting yourself in Dusseldorf.
Oh, I should never be able to follow in the footsteps of these fellows. I'd only make a fool of myself. Swells and snobs and flunkies, all these figures they caricature are absolutely unknown to me. I've never moved in that sort of world.
You soon would if you went to London. I'd get you introductions, old man. In 3 months, you'd be in the swim of society and you'd create a style of your own.
Can you see me? Now, I enjoy loafing here. It's all so damned easy and doesn't require any effort.
Oh, rot, Kiki. I don't believe you. You're itching to get away and do some real work. Now, pull yourself together, old boy, and cut yourself loose from all this.
Shall I? Oh, I don't know. I can't make up my mind. It's all so genial, so... Oh, I don't know.
But there are excellent chances for you in London. If you could get an introduction to a paper as an illustrator, it would be the beginning of a future. I have said already that I'll try to help you.
Oh, my dear old fellow, you're very good. And I will think seriously about it. But let us go to a cafe and see who is there, have some wine, then I will tackle Mama. As Isabella came out here last Christmas to be with her, I'm sure she won't want to be disrupted.
And who is saying that she should be? It's time you were on your own feet.
Emma Whitewick and her mother have been here as well. I don't know when they're leaving. That is another thing that makes me hesitate. Mama, if you will lend me £10, I will go to London and will pay it back to you in 3 months. I will find a cheap lodging and work like a black.
I spoke to Mrs. Whitewick about this affair this morning. They, too, are coming to the end of their time here. And she said that she would ask you into meals and keep an eye on you generally. But still, it is not the same as myself.
Did Emma agree to help?
I have no idea. I will let you have £10 to go to London, but you must be as careful as possible. As for Isabella and myself, we can live as cheaply here as anywhere, I suppose. At any rate for the present, until we know whether you are going to be successful or not.
Oh, I will be successful, Mama. I will make my fortune.
Your father said that he too would make his fortune.
But Papa was different, always dreaming dreams.
You had better see that those dreams are not inherited.
And on a Rhine steamer, 2 days later, sailed Kiki and Tom Armstrong with Emma Whitewick and her mother. On the journey to Rotterdam, Emma looked at Kiki from her corner of the deck and thought him much too thin and too pale. She was sure he had no idea of looking after himself. It wasn't her business, of course, but she wished he had someone to take care of him, bathe his eyes, mend his socks, and give him medicine when he needed it. On Kiki's arrival in London, James Whistler, his old friend from Paris, offered him a share in his studio in Newman Street, and Kiki gladly accepted. Work slowly increased, and on occasion he would illustrate the serial stories of the various periodicals of the day. He obtained an introduction to Mark Lemon, editor of Punch, and from time to time made small contributions to that paper. In April 1861, George Clark died, leaving his wife and child with very little money. His death was a great blow to Ellen in Dusseldorf, and she wrote at once to Louise in the convent at Versailles to tell her the sad news.
I know what your feelings must still be on such a painful subject. My poor brother suffered terribly, but he died calmly. I hope, dear Louise, all is well with you. Kiki is spoken about in the English papers, and the other day a gentleman in Dusseldorf asked if Isabella was a sister of the rising young artist in Punch. It sounds as though you were becoming quite attached to Emma Whitewick. She is an excellent girl, but I can't say that I should like such a connection. And now that her family have lost so much money, it would not suit at all. Anyway, he is as fickle as the wind. I do hope he will not be impetuous.
I never really cared for the theatre in the afternoon, but today's performance I thought perfect. Are you glad we went, Emma?
Very glad. I had never heard Ruy Blas until now, and it seemed to me such
perfect singing. Even you, Kiki, would be hard-pressed to exceed it.
You know, I only sing to amuse people. It was Papa who had the voice.
Alas, that I never heard him, Kiki. Oh, it's such a beautiful evening. Even walking home through Regent Street seems to have a special excitement. Oh, do come away from the curb. Oh. That handsome cab nearly touched you. Oh, they're such dangerous vehicles.
I'm worried about Mama and Isabel. I do wish I could do more for them in Dusseldorf, but every fibre is so important at the moment. I had to send one to Gigi the other day to help him with his debts. Otherwise, he'd be cashiered. Just as I need money myself, all these things occur when...
We would help you if we could, Kiki. But you know Papa's circumstances are much reduced.
Oh, the very idea. But it is sweet and dear of you to think of it.
You do like London, Kiki, do you not?
Oh, I do now. I have many reasons to be grateful to it. One of the greatest is yourself.
Me?
Oh, I cannot hold back any longer. Emma, dearest Emma, will you marry me? For weeks I have longed to say it. Will you marry me?
Are you sure you will not change your mind?
Oh, never, never.
Then I will marry you.
You will?
Yes.
You will?
Oh, put down your umbrella. You can't wave it at people like that. They'll think something's wrong.
Oh, but it isn't. It's the righteous moment in my life. Oh, Emma, I will pluck up my courage and ask Lemon if he will give me a regular order for a drawing in Punch as I want to get married.
And if he doesn't?
There is once a week, and the Cornhill and London Society, they are all taking my work. And when I become better known, the fees will increase.
Yes.
And one day I think I will write stories. I have a lot of notes put away somewhere, and I can easily find them. Well, if they were successful, that too would be a help.
I beg your pardon.
Oh, I'm so sorry, madam.
I think we should walk on, Kiki. We seem to be causing an obstruction on the pavement. Oh, let us go home and hear what Mama and Papa have to say.
I shall have to go to Dusseldorf to tell Mama and arrange for the family. Oh, what does it matter? One day we will be married, and that is the whole world.
Naturally, you will not think of marrying for many years. But as to the engagement, it has my approval.
We want to have the wedding as soon as possible. You know that Emma is not happy at home with her parents, so at variance with each other. The atmosphere is terribly hard for her.
Possibly. All the same...
I know that you are worrying about Isabella's future here in Dusseldorf, but when we are married, she shall come and stay with us. Perhaps she will meet someone she likes in London.
When I think of how well you could have married, it makes me rather indignant, to say the least of it, that the Whitewicks should be favored, and then not give you a sou in return.
Oh, never mind, Mama. When you hold your first grandchild on your knee, you will be reconciled.
When I was young, such subjects were never discussed before marriage.
Why, I've drawn pictures of them already, all with big blue eyes and curly hair like angels.
I hope you have not shown them to Emma.
Indeed, I have. She has them framed in her room.
Then the sooner you get married, the better.
On Kiki's return from Dusseldorf, Mark Lemon confirmed to him that the first vacancy on the Punch staff would be his. Elated, he went to the Whitewicks and said there was no longer any need to postpone the wedding, and it was fixed for the 3rd of January, 1863. Kiki and Emma found rooms in Great Russell Street, just opposite the British Museum, partly furnished with an extra room for Kiki as his studio. The wedding itself was to be a quiet affair with a few personal friends, and afterwards they'd catch the boat for a week's honeymoon in Boulogne. As he took Emma's hand at the altar, he knew that the 29 years that lay behind him counted as nothing, and that this was the beginning. This was a companionship that would continue until death. When success came to him in full measure, with his work on Punch, and later the publication of his novel Trilby, and then Peter Ibbetson, culled from those forgotten notes of his life that were put away in a drawer, he remained unspoilt, and received it with humility. He was certain that his novels didn't deserve this praise, but the public insisted, and George Du Maurier became a figure in the Artistic Society of London. In 1873, a son was born to them, a son they named Gerald. And in that christening cup, the fire flashed once more. And if Gerald Du Maurier did not sing as his grandfather Louis Mathurin sang, he bewitched his audiences in the theatre of the 20th century as they have not been bewitched since his death. And the glass remains, and the fire is waiting, and it glows.